Occasionally, as we get into a new calendar year, I give a sermon on prophecy or give a sermon about where we are in light of Bible prophecy, some prophetic trends perhaps to watch. I tend to view this as kind of a state of the world message. I don't do it every year, but it seems like every few years I'll do that. Or sometimes there's a major event that happens that kind of urges me to speak on that topic. I feel the need to. Other times it may be years before I really think it's something that would be appropriate. In light of current events in our country, I really felt moved to give that type of a message again today. It just seems that there's so much going on. I don't think anyone could dispute that there's been a major pushback against the general direction our country has been heading for the past 8 years or so. The mainstream news media and the pollsters were proven wrong in a presidential election last fall in which someone won by a good margin the electoral vote, but did not win the popular vote. Now, it's not unheard of. It's happened before. In fact, I was looking at an article in USA Today. They had an article on November 7th last year that said there were four previous times that this has happened, where the person who won the most popular votes did not win the Electoral College. One of them was in 1824, next one was 1876, then 1888, and the most recent, prior to last year, was George W. Bush in 2000. Now, I know if any of you watched any of the time leading up to the election, there were a lot of comments about how can these two candidates be the best our country has to offer. I heard many, many people making that comment or asking that question. And, it's not for me to say who's who. It's just, I would say love him, hate him, or view him neutrally. The fact remains that the election of Donald Trump made history in a number of things, broke new ground. It was the first time in recent history that a Washington outsider won the presidency. It was the first time that I can think of, in a long, long time at least, that a wealthy businessman financed much of his own campaign. And from what I read, it was the first time ever that a woman successfully managed a winning presidential campaign. I always forget her name, Kellyanne Conway, I think it is, Kellyanne Conway, whatever. First time in history that anyone has ever done that, that has actually managed a winning presidential campaign. Yet the same platform on which he ran has led to a number of concerns by various countries. Any of you who have watched world news know that there are a number of countries around the world that are concerned right now as he has begun implementing some of his promises. In the last 3 months in our country alone, there have been protests, there have been displays of anger, there's angst. I mean, there has been even vulgar language used against the president in a way that I haven't seen in recent history. It's pretty unprecedented as far as I'm concerned. Race relations have progressively grown worse in our nation. And in fact, they're at the worst level I can recall since the 60s and 70s. I may be wrong, but they sure seem to be that way to me as I watch the news. I'm reminded of a statement Jesus made in Matthew chapter 12. If you'll turn there, Matthew chapter 12. Sorry, I stand back a little bit farther. I think Mr. Flynn scooted this mat up, and I'm standing on the edge of it, so. Matthew chapter 12. Let's turn there. Matthew 12 and verse 25. And now, to just give you a little bit of background of this, the whole reason Jesus is answering the Pharisees and the people around him is because he had cast some demons out. And he was accused. The Pharisee says, well, he's not a prophet of God. He's using the power of Satan to cast these demons out. So this was their accusation against him. In verse 25, it says, but Jesus knew their thoughts, and he said to them, every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation, and every city or house divided against itself will not stand. Now, again, I realize the context has to do with him casting out demons by Satan. He said, well, if Satan's divided against himself, he's going to come to nothing. I mean, what you're saying doesn't make any sense. But the statement is true about any kingdoms, physical or spiritual. As he says, it's even true about cities or true about houses, that if they're divided against themselves, they're not going to stand. And as I look around the country today, sadly, I have to say my opinion is that we are a very divided nation right now. Very divided nation. I'd like to take a little time to review some prophecies as we address a question of where are we now in light of Bible prophecy. If we're going to look at our nation and start talking about the United States, most of us know that if we look for the story, the history of the United States, we really have to go back in the Bible quite a ways. In fact, we have to go back to the time of Abraham when God made some promises to Abraham. Back in Genesis chapter 17 is where I'm going to begin in this brief overview of some of the history of where our nation has come from. Our nation has been the greatest single nation in the world in recent decades, in recent centuries. The last century in particular saw the rise of the United States to a level in the world that was unprecedented. Genesis chapter 17, I'm going to start in verse 1, Genesis 17 and verse 1. It says, when Abraham was, or his name was Abram here before it was changed to Abraham, when Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to him and said, I am Almighty God, walk before me and be blameless. So he's 99 years old, just wanted to establish that particular point by reading verse 1. Let's skip that down to verse 15 now. You can't read all of the intervening parts, but he makes a covenant with him about circumcision. And in verse 15, picking up there again, it says, then God said to Abraham, because he had said your name's going to be Abraham now and not Abram, but as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. So God changed her name also. And I will bless her and also give you a son by her. Then I will bless her and she will become a mother of nations. Kings of people shall come from her. And Abraham fell on his face and laughed, and he said in his heart, shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? I'm 99. By the time a child's born, I'm going to be 100. Is this really going to happen? Wow. And shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? I mean, this is unprecedented. This is strange. And Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. Then God said, no, Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his descendants after him. And as for Ishmael, I've heard you. Behold, I'll bless him, and he will be and make him fruitful, and I'll multiply him exceedingly. He shall beget 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant will I establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this set time next year. So we glean several points from this without spending a lot of time on it. There are several very obvious things. First of all, God performed a miracle for Sarah to have a child at her age. And Abraham became a father at 100 and Sarah a mother. Secondly, Ishmael, though God promised to bless him, Ishmael was not to be the son of promise. Now, I realize if you read the Quran or you read what the Muslims say, they say the Bible is corrupted, the Jews have corrupted it, that it's really Ishmael. That Ishmael was supposed to be the one who is the son of promise. But several times God specifically says, no, it's not Ishmael, it will be, my covenant will go through the son that you will have with Sarah. The blessings would go through Isaac and then through Jacob, not Esau. Esau was the oldest, but it'll go through Jacob and then to Joseph. Now, we know, without going through the history in the Bible, we know Jacob's name was later changed to Israel. He had 12 sons. Joseph was the favored son, and everyone knew it. We heard about favoritism in the sermonette. That family, unfortunately, practiced it, and it was very obvious that Joseph was the favored son of his father. And I'll have to say, every time I read through that story, it was pretty foolish of Joseph to tell his brothers the dreams he had, that they were going to bow down to him. I mean, who does that? I mean, who takes a stick and pokes it in the brother's eyes and says, I'm going to be greater than you. I'm the youngest, but I'm going to be greater than you. I mean, that wasn't wise at all, was it? Talk about lack of godly wisdom at that point in his life. He had some humbling that he needed to go through, and God did that for him. In fact, he was so hated that his brother sold him into slavery. He ended up in prison. And after many years of humbling, he finally became second in command in Egypt. God put him there and brought his family to Egypt to save their lives from a terrible famine. So I'm going to pick it up in Genesis 48, much later in the story, but Genesis 48, at this point, the family has come to Egypt, his father, his brothers, and their family members. In Genesis 48, we find in verse 1, it came to pass after these things that Joseph was told, indeed, your father is sick. And he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. He had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, or Manasseh and Ephraim. And Jacob brought them to his father. In verse 5, skipping down there, he says, as his father Jacob is saying to Joseph, he says, and now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who are born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, they're mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. And in essence, he's adopting them. He said, they're my sons, just like all my other 11 children, and you, the 12th, they're going to be my children too. They're going to be my sons just the same. He claimed them. And we find that as Joseph brings them near, that Jacob crosses his hands. Instead of putting his right hand on the oldest, he puts it on the youngest. And skip down to verse 17, it says, when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, the younger, it displeased him. So he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head. You got him mixed up. As you read, you find that his vision was rather dim. So he apparently mixed it up, and Joseph thought, well, he just doesn't see clearly. And his father refused and said, I know it. I know, my son. I know, in verse 19, he also shall become a people. He also shall be great, but truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. So he blessed them that day, saying, by you Israel will bless, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh. And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. So of the two, Ephraim would be the first. He would be greater than Manasseh, even though he was not the firstborn. In the next chapter, Jacob blesses all 12 sons, but notice the superlatives he gives to Joseph's two sons, which he said were to be his, just like the others. Genesis chapter 49. Skip down to verse 22. It says, and Joseph is a fruitful bough, and obviously this extended to Ephraim and Manasseh as well, a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. But his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hand were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. By the God of your fathers who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you, with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breast and of the womb, the blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors. Up to the uttermost bound of the everlasting hills, they shall be on the head of Joseph, and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. So Joseph was special. He was the one that the special blessings were going to go through. These superlatives, I mean, to the uttermost bounds of the everlasting hills. These were fantastic blessings that were promised to Joseph's two sons. So somewhere in the future, from this time in history, which was around 1700 BC, before they came out of Egypt, we would expect to find two nations that fit these descriptions. One, a group of nations, and secondly, a single nation that was greatly blessed. Let's back up to Genesis 22. I'd like to look at another promise that God made, and I realize I'm really doing a very brief review of some things that there's a lot of this written in, or all of it or more, quite a bit more written in our booklet on the United States and British Commonwealth and Prophecy. Was published last year. But Genesis 22, let's pick it up in verse 17. These are blessings that God conveyed to Abraham, which he said would then go through Isaac and through Jacob, and now we've seen passed on to Joseph. So picking it up in verse 17, Genesis 22, 17, blessings I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven, and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies. Key positions around the world, the gates of your enemies, your descendants are going to possess those. In your seed, verse 18, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. Now we know the ultimate fulfillment of that was Jesus Christ came as a descendant of Abraham, through which all of mankind is able to be blessed. But all nations were to be benefiting from Israel. I realize modern revisionists of history or modern historians do not like to look at the United States as being special or the British Commonwealth as being special. They like to say, well, we're just like anybody else. There's no difference, and these blessings don't really apply. But it just doesn't seem to track when you look at history and you watch what has taken place on the world scene. After the Exodus, right before Moses died, he gave similar blessings in Deuteronomy 33. I won't go there for sake of time. You can look at all the superlatives again in our booklet about this. But we do find the Great Britain in history fits this prophecy of Ephraim being a group of nations, a commonwealth of nations. At one point, for quite some time, it was said the sun never set. It never went down on the British Commonwealth. There was a nation somewhere in the world where the sun was shining, a part of the British Commonwealth. They had nations around the world, possessions around the world. They possessed key gates, key locations around the world. And of course, the United States, after Britain began to wane and the Commonwealth began to break up, the United States became the great world leader, the key superpower in the world. Now, both Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 38, many of you have read these many, many times and know that there's a list of blessings and a list of curses that are pronounced for ancient Israel. If they would obey the old covenant, God would bless them physically. If they disobeyed it, they would end up experiencing some curses. I won't spend a lot of time in it, but I want to go to Deuteronomy 28 and read just a couple of things. Deuteronomy chapter 28. Verse 1, beginning there, Deuteronomy 28, verse 1, it says, "Now it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations of the earth. And all these blessings will come upon you and overtake you because you obey the voice of the Lord your God. Blessed shall you be in the city, blessed shall you be in the country, blessed shall be the fruit of your body, the produce of your ground, the increase of your herds, the increase of your cattle, and the offspring of your flocks." And on it goes about various blessings. I won't turn to Leviticus 26, but in that passage, God even talks about the fact that your threshing will last until the time of vintage, and vintage until the time of plowing. The prophet Amos seems to have taken his cue from that, or paraphrased that, when he made the statement that the plowman would overtake the reaper. The reaper's still trying to gather the harvest, and the plowman saying, "Get out of the way, it's time to plow, we need to plant another crop." This was how God was going to bless God's people that were supposed to be obeying him, if they would obey him. Verses 12 and 13, we find another statement about good treasures, about blessings and land. Verse 12, "The Lord will open to you his good treasure, the heavens, to give the rain to your land in its season, and to bless all the work of your hand. You shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow, and the Lord will make you the head and not the tail. You shall be above only and not beneath, if you heed the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you today, and are careful to observe them." I went on Motley Fool's website a couple of weeks ago. Some of you know who Motley Fool is. It's a group that financial advisors. But they had some interesting charts on their website about national debt and about interest payments. And I found it interesting to look at from around 1940 and 1950 forward, the amount of interest that the U.S. paid was a very tiny thing on the scale. Just a very, very little amount that was paid. We loaned money to other people. We didn't borrow a lot of money from other nations. We had some national debt, but it was minuscule. It was tiny, very small amount, and a very tiny amount that we paid in terms of interest. I'll come back to that in a minute, but it was interesting to see that it was just like a barely above the baseline in terms of the scale that they had to get it on the same page, but comparatively very, very little amount. Verse 15, he begins to turn into the curses. If they didn't obey, it shall come to pass if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments and his statutes, which I command you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Cursed shall you be in the city. Cursed will you be in the country. Your bread basket, your bread kneading bowl, the fruit of your body. It goes on and on. Skip down to verse 25. He says, the Lord will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. You'll go out one way against them and flee seven ways before them. And you shall become troublesome to all the kingdoms of the earth. You shall become troublesome. My margin says you'll be a terror, or nations are not going to like you. You're going to be troublesome, but you're not going to be able to help other nations like you have in the past. Skip down again to verse 43. Again, just skipping through parts of this. Verse 43, the alien who's among you shall rise higher and higher above you, and you shall come down lower and lower. He shall lend to you, but you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you shall be the tail. So, the history of the Old Testament shows that's what happened to ancient Israel. That as they began to cease being true to the covenant of God, their influence in the world began to dwindle. And they began to experience these difficulties. The nation eventually split into Israel and Judah after Solomon's death. God sent prophet after prophet to warn them, but they wouldn't change. And eventually, in 722, Israel went into captivity to Assyria. And around 586 B.C., Judah fell captive to Babylon. So both houses of Israel went into captivity. Yet God said he wouldn't forget his covenant, wouldn't destroy them completely. And those prophecies about Ephraim and Manasseh were not ever fulfilled in the Old Testament. You can read through the whole Old Testament. And yes, there was a time of predominance, especially under the reign of King Solomon, but it wasn't to the degree of what God was promising. And it wasn't evident that Ephraim and Manasseh were fulfilling those. So at some time after they went into captivity, Israel was scattered among the nations. Judah, a small group of Jews, came back to Jerusalem. But Israel remained scattered. So we have to look to more recent history. Jerusalem ultimately was destroyed in AD 70, and it still wasn't. These prophecies weren't fulfilled. So it has to be some time later. We look at more recent history, and again, we see the rise of Britain and then later the United States, and we see that those things do fulfill some of those prophecies. In fact, fulfill those prophecies that God mentioned. You know, for many years, British and the American people had a reputation of showing at least a fair amount of morality. Our founding fathers based much of their thinking on biblical principles. Not all of them were devout Christians, but quite a few of them were, and they at least ascribed to certain biblical principles and values. And for a long time, America, belief in God and basic Christian principles played a large role in American history and in British history and in culture. But just like ancient Israel, Britain and America have been turning away from those biblical values. Britain first. In fact, there's been it's been a number of years since it was said that Britain was no longer a Christian country, that they were a secular people. And we find in our country, if you look at the recent history, there's been a growing hatred of religion, growing immorality, growing breakdown of the family as established by God, and a huge push to accept sinful actions and lifestyles. That's something we have watched, those of us in our adult years have watched happen in the last decade or so, as our nation has become more and more an exporter of things that even people in the world recognize aren't good. Pornography and our movie industry that's always pushing the edge of morality, pushing the edge of decency. Many nations hate us for what we export to the world in along those lines. It's sad to see that happening. You know, as I think about the warnings God gave ancient Israel, Jeremiah lived after Israel had gone into captivity. If you go to Jeremiah chapter 30, I'm going to turn there. He prophesied after Israel had gone into captivity. Judah apparently was not quite in captivity, but Israel had been there for about 100 years. In Jerusalem chapter 30, I'm sorry, Jeremiah 30, Jerusalem. They both start with the letter J, right? Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 1, it says, "The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, Thus speaks the Lord God of Israel, saying, Write in a book for yourself all the words that I've spoken to you. For behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, that I will bring back from captivity my people Israel and Judah." So here, before Judah's even gone into captivity, he's saying, I'm going to bring them back. There will come a time when I'll bring them back. "And I'll cause them to return to the land that I gave their fathers, and they shall possess it." Now, we recognize from other prophecies that's going to happen after Christ's return. And that second Exodus, as it's sometimes called, is going to take place. And when Jesus Christ sets up his government in Jerusalem and all nations begin to flow to Jerusalem and God's law goes out from Jerusalem, then this is going to take place. It hasn't happened yet, but we know that it's going to. Now, before he brings them back, though, notice what he says is going to happen prior to that. There's going to be a time of difficulty. Verse 5, "For thus says the Lord, we have heard a voice of trembling, of fear, and not of peace. Ask now and see whether a man is ever in labor with child." So why do I see a man? I mean, it's obviously, that doesn't happen. So he says, so why is it that we see every man with his hands on his loins like a woman in labor and all faces turned pale? "Alas, for that day is great. There's none like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble. But he shall be saved out of it." Now, Jacob's trouble is a time that we believe the descendants of Israel, Britain, and America are going to experience. He describes it as a horrible time because of the sins of our nation. And yet, as we sang in that hymn, the middle hymn at the beginning, God will see us through that too, won't he? God will see us through. He'll see us through that time of difficulty. But it will be a time of difficulty from what we see in Bible prophecy for our nation. I believe we're witnessing a bit of a cultural civil war going on right now. It's a war between the humanistic anti-religious group. Many describe them as the left and those who call themselves the right. Right sounds better than wrong, doesn't it? I mean, than left. But the right have chosen that name for themselves. A bit more religious. They seem to be at least somewhat focused on biblical values, although they don't follow all of the Christianity that Jesus Christ taught in the New Testament teaches. It's interesting to look at Isaiah 29. If we're thinking in terms of Jerusalem, Isaiah chapter 29, let's turn there. God spoke about his people through the prophet Isaiah, and he said, "Inasmuch as these people draw near me with their mouths," Isaiah 29:13, "and honor me with their lips, but have removed their hearts far from me, and their fear towards me is taught by the commandments of men, therefore I will again do a marvelous work among this people." It's people claim to know God, people claim to follow God, and yet they don't really follow all of what he said. They're simply following the laws of man. They're following men's ideas about Christianity. Again, we appear to be more divided as a nation than ever. The animosity between the two sides seems to be growing. The secularists, if we want to call them that, and the religions, those who are wanting at least to have some semblance of biblical principles. And the pushback seems to be getting more and more vocal between the two. More animated. In one sense, more uncivilized. As I look at recent history, it seems that one side has kind of pushed us to the brink of financial disaster. As I said, I was on Motley Fool's website recently. And you look at what has happened in terms of our national debt and the amount of money that's going to have to be paid in interest payments is about to turn the corner and go almost straight up, according to their projections. That's where we are with our national debt. We haven't seen it yet, but it's coming. is right around the corner. It's a very difficult time that's coming with financial issues. And now we see the other side coming to power, and some think, well, they're going to save America. I don't think so. But that's their idea, that they're going to pull us back from this brink of financial disaster. And I don't think they're going to be successful in that either. I wonder, I'm just leveling with you today in my own ponderings, has God allowed this? Has he allowed the shift between the two to take place so that now we have, in a sense, the religious right in power, only to show they don't really have the answers either? And they're not going to be able to save our nation. They're not going to be able to resolve everything. For one thing, the other side doesn't want it. And there is a growing power on that other side. Look at all the demonstrations you see. Look at all the hateful things that are being done and said. It's a very powerful movement. When you get Hollywood and a good bit of the news media and a lot of others that seem to be a similar mindset, there's a very strong power in that. And the new president, I mean, some people think he's great. Others say, I don't know that I've ever seen such an ego in the president of the United States. Can't take any criticism. He's got to slam people on Twitter, and some people say they ought to take his Twitter account away. I don't know. I don't know what God has in mind. But it is an unusual situation, is all I'm saying. Our nation is in a very unusual situation. Is this God's way of proving that mankind cannot resolve his problems? That the division that Satan fosters in societies is going to bring disaster no matter what? That's the question in my mind. Some of the things that our new administration thinks will solve problems is actually angering nations overseas, scaring Europe. I don't know how many of you follow, read the articles that are with the LHT weekly newsletter, but they have a news update at the bottom of each of them. I read these quite often, and I've highlighted things that have to do with Europe and their fear of the new presidency, the new administration in the United States, saying, we can't count on them to protect us. If they go into isolationism where they want America first and they're not going to support NATO and they're not going to support us, we better get strong ourselves. We better strengthen ourselves in Europe. They're worried about their military or the need for a military if the United States is not going to step in and help them. Will that be a trigger that brings about some other prophecies? Let's remind ourselves of a couple of those prophecies. Turn with me to Revelation chapter 17. At the return of Jesus Christ, there is a group that is described. There's going to be a powerful group. In Revelation chapter 17, without going through the whole history of this, we can read a little bit of it. Beginning in verse 12, he says, the ten horns that you saw, this is a vision that John saw. It's the revelation of Jesus Christ that was given to John. And he says, the ten horns that you saw, this angel that's speaking to John, says they're ten kings. They've not yet received a kingdom, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are the called, the chosen, and faithful. So this is Jesus Christ they fight against at Christ's return. They make war with the Lamb, capital L. The translators knew this was the Lamb of God that is being talked about. So these ten kings, representing nations or nationalities or groups of people or ethnic groups, can be described anyway in terms of the Greek, these ten give their power to the beast to become a part of that power. They give up their sovereignty. That's been one of the issues in Europe, hasn't it? As we've watched Europe over the years, over the past several decades, they'll get stronger and then they'll get weaker, and they'll get stronger and get weaker. Now we've seen Britain, who's always been opposed to a central power and a central army in Europe, Britain's exiting. Britain's getting out. And now we see other nations that are beginning to say in Europe, we need to be stronger. We need our own army. These 10 kings, these 10 ethnic groups that cede their power to him are going to exist at the return of Christ, the beast power. Now, where is that? Is that beast power centered in Britain? Is it in the Middle East? Is it in Asia? Is it in America? Well, I don't think that's where it's going to be centered. Where else do we find 10 kings or 10 nations that exist to fight at the return of Jesus Christ? Well, it's in the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 2. Remember the image? Let's go to Daniel 2. Remember the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw? He had this dream in the middle of the night. He can't sleep anymore because of this dream. It scares him. Book of Daniel. We'll turn and look at the story here. This Gentile king. He can't sleep. Verse 1, the second year, Daniel 2 and verse 1. Now, in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. And his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. And he wanted to know what this dream meant. I mean, these dreams that he kept seeing, this was something that really, really bothered him. And so he said, well, call the wise men. And the wise men come in and they say, okay, tell us what your dream was. He said, no, I'm not telling you the dream. I'll tell you the dream and you'll come up with something. I want you to tell me what the dream is, then you tell me what it means, and then I'll know you know what you're talking about. Well, look, no one's ever asked that of the wise men before. And he said, well, I'm asking it. And when they couldn't do it, he said, kill them all. What value are you to me? And of course, it eventually came to Daniel that they were going to told him he was going to be killed as well. He said, well, now wait, why is it so urgent? Give us a day or two. Let's see if God will reveal it. And God did. God revealed to Daniel exactly what it was. He revealed that these were, what he saw was an image. And without going through all of the story, verse 29 begins to talk about that it's God who's revealed it. In verse 31, he talks about the image that he saw. This was a great image that had a head of gold, it had a chest and arms of silver, belly and thighs of bronze, and legs of iron. Feet were partly iron and partly clay. And he watched, he said, in verse 34, I will read that. When you watched while a stone was cut out without hands, it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. So where is this stone focused? It's focused on the feet. It's focused on the toes and the feet of this image. And then in verse 36, he begins to tell him the interpretation. You're the head of gold, Nebuchadnezzar. After you, there's going to be another world ruling empire. It's going to be silver. It's not quite as strong as you, but it's going to be a silver. So you look at Nebuchadnezzar, you look at Babylon, then you find after Babylon what came next, the Persian Empire. And then this next one's going to be bronze, that it's going to be the third kingdom. Well, what was the world ruling kingdom after Persia? Well, it was the Greek. It was the Greeks. Alexander conquered the world, encroached even further into Europe and further over into Asia than the other two kingdoms had. And finally, he says the fourth one is going to be a fourth kingdom that's like iron in verse 40. It's going to stamp in pieces. It'll break and it'll crush everything else. It's what the Roman Empire did. Its Roman legions were feared throughout the world. And they encompassed all of Europe. Well, for you, I guess it's this side. All of Europe, all of the Middle East, and a big part of Asia. But they were centered in Europe. They took Greece and they took the Greek culture for their world ruling empire. But look at what he says in terms of this fourth kingdom, as strong as iron in verse 40. Crushes and it breaks and crushes in pieces. In verse 41, whereas you saw the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Still speaking about this Roman Empire, it shall be partly divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And the toes, as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay, they'll mingle with the seed of men, but they'll not adhere to one another, just as iron doesn't mix with clay. So up to this point, here's this world-ruling empire, and there's some mixture at this point that he's talking about these toes. But look at the next verse, because the next verse shows us that this is a time sequence that comes all the way up to the return of Jesus Christ. That this Roman Empire, while it vanished early in the 300s, 400s, It came back again in Europe. And then it came back again, and it came back again. There were various revivals of that Roman Empire. And in verse 44, still this fourth kingdom, in the days of these kings, the kings that were the toes, the ten toes, in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron and bronze and clay and silver and gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. God has revealed the dream to me, king, and the interpretation he gave me, it's not my interpretation, it's certain. It is guaranteed. It is absolute that this is going to happen. The final revival of this Roman Empire is going to exist with kings, the ten toes, that don't mesh that well. And it's going to be in their days that the stone, Jesus Christ, destroys that kingdom. So if we let the Bible interpret itself, something that we want to do, we see the beast power is the last revival of the Roman Empire, which has always been centered in Europe. So that's why we look at the EU. It's gotten stronger over years. It's waned. It's gotten stronger again, only to weaken again. But it has not ceased to exist. And today we see a European Union that's pretty scared. If you watch world events, they're worried about Russia. I keep thinking in terms of my map for you, Russia from Europe. They're concerned about Russia. It's nibbling at the eastern ends of Eastern Europe. They're worried about what Russia is going to do. And now they're worried about the United States, that the United States might not protect them. They're worried about all of the influx of refugees, all of those who have come into, immigrating into Central Europe. They're worried about the U.S. lessening their support under the new president. Will that ultimately be what leads them to set up their own army? Maybe. We may be watching prophecy about to be fulfilled. Britain left. Britain partly left because they didn't want to give up their sovereignty. That was one of the big issues in Brexit. They didn't want to cede more and more power to a central European Union. Been watching some of the articles in the Prophetic Times. This is actually published by a pastor in United, but he cites a lot of articles from various places. Found a very similar article in the LHT News letter about the European Union concerned about what's happening and emphasizing their need for a stronger integration. And here's an interesting quote from Angela Merkel. She's Germany's leader at this point. The last few years, Merkel told reporters, said that the last few years showed that the EU may integrate at different speeds. Not everyone will take part on the same levels of integration. One area where governments are divided is over the degree of integration of defense. With the departure of long skeptic Britain, France and Germany are keen to develop closer EU ties. And, as other articles go on to point out, to establish their own military. They recognize the need for their own, at least in their mind, the need for a military. So, it's interesting to think about what we may be watching. Jesus Christ, in the Olivet Prophecy, talked about a number of things that would happen before Christ's return. I won't read through all of that, but let's go to Matthew 24. A couple of things just to pick up here. Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, they're all talking about the same event when people came to Jesus, the disciples, first of all, and they asked him what would be the sign of his coming, what would be the sign of the end of the age, what would be the sign that they were getting close. And Jesus began to explain different things to them, telling them in verse 4, Matthew 24, Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name saying I'm the Christ and will deceive many, and you'll hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not troubled. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet." I mean, we've seen wars since Jesus Christ died and was resurrected and went back to heaven. Well, there's been wars in the world. Seems like recently, we're seeing more and more concerns about wars. We're seeing a growing worry in the Middle East. ISIS claimed responsibility for 4 rockets that were fired into modern Israel just this week from down in the Sinai Peninsula. And 3 of them were shot down. The 4th one fell out in the middle of nowhere, so they didn't bother to shoot it down with their Iron Dome defenses. But there's worry about Iran. Iran wanted the ability to make missiles that could reach to Europe. And according to one of the articles I was reading here, this is actually from the New York Post. It says the secret Iran deal made by President Obama took the position that it wasn't a treaty, and they were going to allow the Iranians to build ballistic missiles capable of up to 2,000 miles of flight. Why 2,000 miles? Because that would get to all of Israel. They could reach all of Israel. Well, now they're testing missiles, according to this article, with a range of 2,500 to 5,000 miles. Guess where that reaches? Reaches all the way to Europe. So now Europe's beginning to be concerned about Iran, where they weren't before because they thought they were protected. Wars, rumors of wars, worries of wars, they've always been, but it just seems to me that we're seeing an increase in those. Verses 7 and 8, for nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines, pestilences, earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Well, there's always been disasters, always been famines, always been earthquakes. But again, seems like there's going to be more to come before Christ's return. And then he lists tribulation, heavenly signs, same things that are mentioned in the book of Revelation with those 4 horsemen of the apocalypse and then the seals. But notice what he says. Verse 13, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. Regardless of what we see around us, we have to know God is in control. And if we endure, if we stay faithful, God will be with us. Verses 36 to 39 say, we don't know when it's going to happen. Of that hour and day, or day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. So we don't know when it's going to happen. We know that God does say he promised his church would never die out. In Revelation chapter 12, we go back to the prophecies in Revelation. Look at Revelation 12. There's a woman who gives birth to a child. And child is capitalized by the translators. They recognize it to be a reference to the church or the reference to Jesus Christ as a child. There is a dragon that is mentioned in this chapter. The dragon is identified in verse 9 as the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast out to the earth. Skip down to verse 12. He says, therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you that dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows he has a short time. When the dragon saw he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. But the woman was given 2 wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. So Satan makes war with the church. And God says he protects the church for a time, singular, times, plural, and half a time, 3.5 years. And God says he protects his people. Jesus Christ made a statement as well in Luke 21. Go there as we begin to wrap this up. Luke chapter 21, again, the Olivet prophecy. And Jesus tells us that we need to be alert, we need to be watching, and we need to be praying. We need to be aware of ourselves. We watch ourselves, first of all, but we also watch world events. We look around to see what's happening. Don't bury your heads in the sand. Don't ignore what's going on. We can't tell exactly where we are because we don't know the day and the hour. But as we see things beginning to be fulfilled and we see the potential for more things to be fulfilled, we should be alert to them. We should be careful about how we live Verse 33 of Luke chapter 21, let's pick it up there. He says, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. What I'm telling you, he said, is more sure than the planet you're standing on. It's more sure than heaven and earth. It will not pass away. But take heed to yourselves, first of all, watch ourselves, watch what we do. Take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and the cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. We have to be alert. Jesus said, be alert, watch, watch yourselves, be careful about how you live, but watch, because I will protect and pray that you will be a part of those, that you be counted worthy to escape all of those issues. So we need to stay close to God. We need to rely on Him. We can't rely on ourselves. We're not going to be able to prevent things. But trust God, the one who says His words are sure and will not pass away. So where are we today? Where are we in terms of Bible prophecy? Well, we're in somewhat serious times, I would say, as a nation. We're in pretty difficult times. Jesus said, any nation, any kingdom divided against itself won't stand. Unfortunately, as I look around, that's what I see in our country today, that we're a nation divided, very bitterly divided. Some of the protests that I've seen are just, I mean, they're vulgar, some of the things that are done. It's terrible. We're divided. We don't know the day or the hour, but we know we're getting closer to Christ's return. Maybe a little sobering to think along these lines today. But remember, God says, stay close to me. Just like He told ancient Israel, if you'll obey me, if you'll follow, if you'll be true to the covenant, I'll bless you. I'll do all these things for you. God is no less powerful today than He was then. No less powerful. If we trust God, if we're close to God, we watch ourselves and we're alert to what's going on, we won't be taken by surprise. And God does promise that He has our best interest at heart.